Let's talk science fiction tonight with none other than Mark Zakrie. We'll be back with Mark in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, let me tell you a little bit about him. Mark Zakrie has more than 100 dramatic television credits to his name, including episodes of Star Trek, The Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Babylon 5, Twilight Zone, and Sliders. Mark has also served on staff of the series, which includes Lazarus Man, Beyond Reality, and Friday the 13th, the series. He's written a number of pilots for television. Additionally, he has been a commentator for years for NPR's Morning Edition, author of the bestseller, The Twilight Zone Companion, Magic Time. And here he is, Mark Zakrie. Mark, how are you? Good morning.
I'm very good, George. It's so good to talk with you again.
You too, my friend. Keeping busy writing these days, I hear, huh?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. It's a lot of fun here in Tinseltown.
What do you tell people who want to be writers?
You know, it's funny because I mentor a lot of writers and directors and producers and so forth. And the great thing is that now it's much easier to get the attention of the studios and the networks, thanks to the internet, thanks to a lot of things. It's just so much easier. People can just pick up a camera at the electronics store and get, you know, Final Cut, which is an editing program, put it on their Mac, and they're good to go. They can shoot the equivalent of a network show or a movie and really get some notice.
CBS just cut some programs, including Ghost Whisperer, which was doing very well.
Yes.
I guess they're all assessing where they're going, aren't they?
Yeah, you know, and the networks are, it's so expensive to make a network show right now. For instance, any network drama, the budget's going to be anywhere from $2 to $5 million per episode. That's a lot of money going out the door. But the great thing about television is that, you know, when you make a TV series, thanks to DVD and the internet now, you know, these shows are around pretty much forever. And in fact, there are shows that I wrote for when I was in my early 20s that, you know, people still are contacting me about, and they, you know, they release them on DVD and Blu-ray all the time. So it's sort of eternal.
I'm curious, over the weekend, did anybody say that they heard you on KFI here in Los Angeles?
They did. They did. It's great fun to know that I'm out there talking even while I'm sleeping. So
we reran you on the network along with Ann Serling.
Wow, how fun.
And that's what's great about radio too. These things live forever like TV shows.
Yes, exactly. It's really eternal. It's great fun to be part of this wonderful business.
Are you still doing pilots?
Yeah. In fact, I'm working on three right now, and it's very fun because, again, you know, there's one, you mentioned Ghost Whisperer, and the people who run that show, Ian Sander and Kim Moses, have optioned Magic Time, and that's based on the pilot and then the three novels that I did for HarperCollins, and it's a very interesting strategy because last night we were shooting a trailer, a little, you know, sort of commercial for the project, and then we're going to do it as a web series, build the audience, then go to network television with it. And my friend Armin Shimerman, who played Quark on Deep Space Nine and the principal on Buffy, I've worked with him on many shows and pilots. He was there with me and David Paulson, who's another actor who's worked with Ray Bradbury, and we were just shooting it. There's a fellow named Trey Stokes who's been directing wonderful things on the internet, and I brought him aboard. He's very talented, a great special effects guy, and we were just shooting it on a little stage here in L.A. And then I'm writing a new script that I'm going to do what's called a table read, which is where you get actors around a table and you read it out loud and you hear it, and that really helps you refine it. That's a new one called Savage Donut Paradise, which is sort of a callback to the Thin Man, Nick and Nora Charles. It's sort of a 21st century take on that kind of a whodunit set on the Sunset Strip at night. So very fun project.
What's the craze with sci-fi shows, Mark? I mean, it's huge. I mean, in you know, mystical comets. You and I, next weekend, we're going to be in Pasadena at an event.
Yeah, the Rock and Comic Con at Pasadena, the convention center. It's going to be a great, fun event. And I think your question is really a great one, George, because when you ask about the science fiction, why it's so popular and so long-lasting, it's funny, you know, if you look at something like the original Star Trek, which is still popular, still people love it, and if you compare that with other shows that debuted in 1966, they seem so dusty, these westerns and so forth, Gunsmoke or whatever. But you watch Star Trek and with Starship Enterprise and Aliens, it's still really thrilling and really adventurous and seems much more current. And again, if you look at some of the shows that are being greenlit for the fall, there's a new show coming down the pike called Terra Nova that Steven Spielberg is doing. And it's about, it takes place in the future when Earth's resources have been depleted. So they're sending people to sort of other parallel Earths. and there's a parallel Earth that has dinosaurs on it, no people but dinosaurs, and they're sending human beings' families there to survive. And it's a very thrilling concept. And so I think that science fiction just kind of excites people's imaginations. And, you know, and I think that the what-if quality is, you know, endlessly intriguing. I think people really, really do still resonate to the possibility of the future and other realities.
Is it as strong as it was in the past, this love of sci-fi?
Yes, I think so. I think so. And I think also that when you really hit a nerve and find a profound truth in science fiction, it lasts. And I'll give you an example of that. Probably the first great science fiction movie ever made was a film called Metropolis that Fritz Lang did in 1927. It came out in 1927, and it was after its initial showing in Germany, it was truncated, cut severely, and so Americans never even saw the complete version. And they recently found 25 minutes that were thought to be lost, and they've just restored them, and they screened a print of it in L.A. I think it'll eventually be on home video. And it was just phenomenal to see this amazing film with great robot, great futuristic city. It really held up. And last week I also saw my friend Ray Bradbury, and, you know, when you talk about Fahrenheit 451 or The Martian Chronicles, you know, these things are every bit as truthful and resonant now as they were when Ray wrote them in 1950.
Or one of my favorite Twilight Zones, I Sing the Body Electric.
Yes, 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 yes. And a great script by Ray. And it was fun when you and I were doing the commentaries on the Twilight Zone Blu-ray. And I ended up doing 52 episodes.
52 of them, Mark?
52 audio commentaries, yeah. And so that's 30 hours of me talking.
That's a lot.
So I think so.
You had fun doing that.
I did, very much. And well, having you and I did a couple of episodes, George, and I got Richard Donner to do some, and Neil Gaiman, who's a very popular science fiction and fantasy writer, many, many wonderful people. And you know, you watch these episodes, and you just see that they really hold up. I mean, just to sit down with Richard Donner, who directed, I mean, more recently he did Lethal Weapon and Superman with Christopher Reeve, but back then he directed Nightmare 20,000 Feet, and, you know, that's the one with William Shatner on the airplane wing. And just to sit and talk with him, watch the episode with him and talk for a half hour about how that was made was just a revelation. It was just such great fun.
Well, I was telling you this story, and I'll share this. One of my granddaughters for Christmas last year said, "Papa, I want a Twilight Zone movie." And I went, "Well, okay, I'll get you one." And she said, "No, I want the Talkie Tina one." And I said, "What do you want that one for?" And she said, "Because I just want it." So not only did I got her a lot of stuff for Christmas, but I got her the DVD of the Twilight Zone, not the mastered one that you did with Blu-ray, but the old one of Talkie Tina. It was in there with the mix. And I also found a company out here in Los Angeles, and I bought a little Talkie Tina doll, a little ceramic thing, and it talks. You push the button in the back, and it goes, "I'm Talkie Tina. I'm going to get you." Anyways, I gave her that too, and she looked at it, and it freaked her out when she heard it talk. And my daughter, her mother, said to Mia, let me just put it in your toy box. And she went, "No, Mommy, it'll crawl out at night." So every time she came home from school, the doll would be on the mantle, and she would get on a chair and turn it around where the back was facing. But when you and I did the interview on your Master of the Twilight Zone and that segment, Talkie Tina, you looked at this little doll. You were just amazed by it. I gave it to you.
You did. In fact, it's sitting right here in my office even as we speak, and I was so moved by that present, George. It's great fun. And of course, June Foray, who is the voice of Rocky the Flying Squirrel, did the voice of Talkie Tina. And I met her a few years ago, and it was great fun to reminisce about the Twilight Zone with her. So these things really last. They really speak to us. And there's nothing I think creepier than a talking doll.
Oh, I know. The little girl who was in that Talkie Tina episode, not the doll, but the little girl, she was in another one also, wasn't she?
Little Girl Lost. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah,
another classic.
Yes. Yeah. Great episodes. And it was also so amazing with the Blu-ray, because I sat down with, you know, some of the writers from the Twilight Zone, like Earl Hamner and George Clayton Johnson, and just again to hear them talk about how they came up with those ideas and really get to the nitty gritty of it and say, okay, well, you know, and see, I mean, to sit with George Clayton Johnson and do the commentary on Kick the Can or Game of Pool, like we did four of his great episodes. We did Nothing in the Dark, you know, and Penny for Your Thoughts, and just to hear him talk about how he came up with those, and he and Charles Beaumont and some of the other Twilight Zone writers would just drive around at night and talk about ideas and talk about their lives and just come up with these things, and it was just phenomenal to reminisce.
I know you have a passion for one of these three things, because, you know, I do too. I mean, I just love this radio show. Even though I've done television programs and some books, this radio show for me is so important, and I just enjoy it. You do books, TV shows, and films. What is your favorite?
It's funny because I love all of them, and I've done radio too, as you mentioned it before when I was on NPR, and I get a lot of strokes for being on Coast to Coast. I got to tell you, George, it was one time I was having a meeting here in Hollywood, and I was pitching something, and from another office, someone said, "That voice. Is that Mark Scott Zickrey? I got to meet him." And he came in. It was the head of the company, and he recognized me from hearing me on Coast to Coast.
That's amazing.
But I think of all the media I work in, I love TV the best. I enjoy doing novels. I enjoy doing movies. But TV, you know, when you're on a show, when you're on, for instance, when I was on Sliders as a writer producer, you come up with an idea, you write it. You know, like in 1 week you'll outline it, the next week you'll write it. A week later you might be in pre-production. A week after that you might be shooting, and then a few weeks later it airs. And the speed of it, and the immediacy, and just how direct it is between the idea and the execution. I just love that that process.
Will TV get back to more drama or comedy?
Yeah.
You think it will? You don't think it's going to keep going in the reality genre?
It's funny. This week they've been having what they call the upfronts in New York, where they announce the fall schedules. And they're doing a lot of dramas, a lot of comedies, scripted television. Because the Jay Leno experiment failed
miserably.
Yeah,
Joe Buck's failed on HBO.
Yeah, and so basically, I think they recognize that people have a hunger for story. They love characters. They love stories. They love, you know. I mean, it's just such a durable medium, you know, fiction. And so I think it really does last. And there's some great, great, great artists working in television, great writers, great, great directors, great actors. You can find really good work if you look for it.
Will anthology like The Twilight Zone ever come back?
It's a very hard format to get the networks to agree to. You and
it
I
is.
Know that from our adventures.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Every now and then, it always takes a visionary, not just creating the show, but on the network side to greenlight it. And, Rod Serling was very, very lucky to pitch Twilight Zone at a moment when the network executives were open to something that inventive and that daring. And that can come around again. It just takes the right person who has the power to greenlight something.
I wonder who he had to pitch. Mm. Was it? Do you think it was Paley?
Well, it was no. It wouldn't have been Paley. I mean, ultimately, he would have
approved it.
Given the green, yes.
In those days.
But back then, you know, William Dozier was one of the executives he was working with, and under him was an executive named William Self. They were very smart men, and they really liked what Rod was writing. But even so, Rod had to do a number of pilots of The Twilight Zone before the final one sold. The first one he wrote was something called The Time Element, that was about a man going back in time to Pearl Harbor, and he wrote it as a Twilight Zone pilot. It was an hour long, and CBS shelved it. And then it was made as an episode of Desilu Playhouse, because the producer of that show, Bert Granite, heard about it. He made it as an episode of Desilu Playhouse. It was very popular, and that convinced CBS to give Rod another chance at a pilot. He wrote one called The Happy Place. That didn't get made. He wrote another Twilight Zone pilot called I Shot an Arrow into the Air, which he used as a title of a different episode, but this script never got made. And finally, he wrote Where Is Everybody, which was a half-hour pilot that did get made. And that was the one that convinced CBS to greenlight the show. But it took a lot of perseverance on Rod's part.
I felt so sorry for the Walter Koenig and his family.
Yes.
After hearing the episode of his son.
Yes, yes. And it's, these people who play some of the beloved characters on television.
By the way, Walter, by the way, played Chekhov.
Played Chekhov on Star Trek, yes. And, but these people, they're so dear to us because we get to know them on television and they feel like family. And I, of course, got to know Walter personally. Here in my career and in my life, he's a dear, dear man, and you never wish any kind of tragedy on anyone. But certainly, these people seem very close to us and very dear to us. So, our hearts go out to him.
You're bringing your wife Elaine out to the event?
Yes, 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 yes.
That's
of course. And it's interesting because Elaine is also a writer and a director and a producer, and she's currently setting up three features, juggling those and a web series. So it's very fun. She's got a director and a producer attached to one of her projects, so we were very happy about them. The fun thing about this director, he did a film called The Line with Ray Liotta that did very well recently on DVD, and Elaine wrote this script for him, specifically, this new script, and she gave it to him. He read it that day, and that afternoon he said, yes, I'm in. I want to do this. And so it's very fun. In Hollywood, you often wait so long for things to happen, and so when something happens quickly, you really cheer.
The legendary Stan Lee will be out there.
Yes, he will. And he's amazing. When you meet him, he's in his 80s, but he's still very vibrant.
Lots of energy.
Oh, my God. Yeah, just an amazing man. When you think, here's the guy who came up with, you know, Spider-Man and Thor and Daredevil.
Iron Man.
Yeah,
amazing. Fantastic Four, Avengers, X-Men.
Phenomenal. Just phenomenal.
He did the Incredible Hulk, too, didn't he?
Yes, yes. So this is just an amazing, amazing man. I mean, when you think about the number of immortal characters he's created, he's sort of the comic book equivalent of Charles Dickens, you know, when you just look at the amazing stories and characters he created.
Well, I wish I had all my old comic books.
Oh, I think we all do.
I threw them all out. I had all the old ones.
Yeah, me too.
All of them.
Me too. Me too. Well, when I was researching the Twilight Zone Companion, I interviewed an actor named Don Gordon, and he remembered as a kid buying and reading Superman #1 and Batman #1 and throwing them out. So,
what would they be worth today if they were in pristine condition?
I think the first Superman comic just went for $500,000.
No.
Yeah, yeah. So, So that was an expensive error on his part.
A friend of mine's father has a Honus Wagner baseball card
wow.
in St. Louis, worth yeah. he said $1.5 million.
Wow. Holy cats. Well, it's funny because I'm actually going to be auctioning off some of my Star Trek collection later this year, and I have a panel, a little view screen from the original bridge of the Enterprise. It was used all the way from the first Star Trek pilot to the last original Star Trek episode. It shows the Enterprise side view and top view. And it was one of these things where I just had it for a while. I thought it's time to let someone else treasure it, and we'll see who bids on it. But it's very interesting that when you find out who the top Star Trek collectors are. They're, you know, it's fascinating how that world works.
Who's Norman Corwin?
My friend Norman Corwin is, well, first of all, he was the great writer of radio. He was so famous that when World War II ended in Europe, they said to Norman, we need you to write a one-hour drama on what it means that we've just won this war, what it means and what it's going to mean, and it aired on all the networks simultaneously with no commercials. It was called On a Note of Triumph, and Norman was the guy that both Ray Bradbury and Rod Serling wanted to grow up to be. And the amazing thing, considering the fact that Norman Corwin was born in 1910, is the fact that we just celebrated his 100th birthday.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, and even more amazingly, his brother just turned 107, and his dad made it to 110.
Whoa!
So those are good genes, George.
And great genetics.
Yeah, and it's funny because they had all these celebrations on his birthday, and he said if I'd known that I was going to be so honored on this day, I would have aged more rapidly.
You know, is he active?
Yes, amazingly. He just had a book come out this year, and he's been teaching at USC, and we're going to be taking him out to lunch shortly. He also wrote a movie called Lust for Life that starred Kirk Douglas as Vincent Van Gogh. He was nominated for an Oscar for that, and they just screened it at the American Cinematheque here in L.A.
He's probably up listening to you right now.
You never know. You never know. You never know.
What's new on Zikri.com?
Well, we have one of the most fun things on Zikri.com is that you can watch the entire Star Trek episode with George Takei that I co-wrote and directed and executive produced that came out just a year or so.
That's the one you promised me a starring role, and I never got called.
That'll be the next time, George.
But it's in the mail, right?
Yeah, and I have blogs, and I have all sorts of scripts up online that people can read, and all sorts of really fun things. So Zikri.com is always fun.
Let's take some phone calls when we come back, Mark. You're always fun, and let's have a little fun for the rest of this half hour that we've got with Mark Zikri. Questions about the Twilight Zone, sci-fi shows, fire away. You're next with us on Coast to Coast AM. After Dark is the official magazine of Coast to Coast AM. You get it every month. How do you subscribe? You can call this toll-free number, 1-888-261-6392. That's 1-888-261-6392. Or go online at coasttocoastam.com. Comes out every month, full color. It's a great magazine. Now, the mentoring of people, they're all over the country, all over the world, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, you know, Elaine and I teach classes, and we mentor anyone who wants to be a writer or a director or a producer anywhere in the world. And so we have students in Australia and France and everywhere, and it's great fun. It's great fun because, you know, people often think that they have to come to Hollywood to make movies to really get going on things. They don't. They don't. They can do it anywhere now.
That's super. Let's take some calls here, Mark. We'll pick it up and go to Gates, North Carolina. That's where it is. First-time caller. Hey, Rob, go ahead.
Hey, it's a pleasure to speak to both of y'all tonight.
Thanks, Robbie.
Thanks.
Just a quick question for you. From a creative stance and a production stance, what do you think about and what goes into some of these ghost hunting shows that you see on TV as far as, you know, if they were writing anything or... what goes into that, something like that?
Well, you know, reality shows have sort of a different way of doing things than, like, a fiction show. You know, because with a fiction show, I'll just have an idea, I'll sit down, I'll write the script, then they'll, you know, shoot it. with reality shows, they kind of get, I think they get suggestions from various people. They're looking for where to send their crew. They're looking for stories that might be kind of different from each other, but kind of still be, like, for instance, with a ghost hunter kind of show, they want to create a spooky atmosphere, so they'll listen for what, you know, they probably listen to Coast to Coast a lot. I think Coast to Coast actually is an inspiration for a lot of TV shows, both fictional and non-fictional. So it's much more that, you know, they're looking for reality that they can kind of turn toward their own purposes. But you know, from friends of mine who work in reality TV, a lot of it is much more fictionalized than you might think. There's, you know, it's very little of reality TV is actually really real. And it's sort of like wrestling used to be in the old days, where it was, you know, some people thought it was genuine and it wasn't. But so that's how it works in sort of a lot of the ghost hunter things, where they're just kind of creating an atmosphere and then packaging it a certain way to give that spooky feeling.
So a lot of the evidence and things of that nature may or may not be actual.
Yeah, I take it with a grain of salt, but there's probably a little kernel of truth in there, but still, you know, the buyer beware.
I understand. Well, I appreciate your time. I appreciate y'all taking my call tonight. It's a pleasure listening to y'all.
You're very welcome, Rob.
What's new? What else you have on your plate these days, Mark?
Well, I just I have a friend named Steve Altman who's a novelist and a screenwriter.
Oh, I know Steve real well.
Yes, and we just we wrote a script called Controllers. It's this it's a science fiction show about the people who secretly control everything, and so that's there's a management company called Pitt Group, and they love this script, and they're going to go out wide with it, and so we're meeting with them on Friday, but it's very exciting. It's a script I really love. It came out very, very well. And so it's going to be a lot of fun to run with that project.
Super. Steve's a good person. Tell him hi for me.
I will.
Louisville, Kentucky. Mike, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Mike.
Oh, George, how are you?
Good.
Good to speak with you again. I talked to you last time when Richard C. Hoagland was on.
Oh, sure.
And really enjoyed it. I enjoy every show. Mr. Zirkery, I wanted to ask you something.
Sure.
One of the things that I've been doing since I've been retired is sort of amateur sci-fi and fantasy writing.
Cool.
But I haven't, you know, published anything. I've got but some of it's been circulated around among family and friends, you know, and even a couple of literature professors, and I've gotten good reviews.
Oh, great.
On my work. My work is something similar to their short stories, and they're almost like Twilight Zone episodes.
Well, that's great.
Beg your pardon?
Well, that's terrific. It's a lot of fun to write Twilight Zone kind of stories.
I almost feel like I've been inspired by Rod, and I feel like he's sitting right beside me, you know, helping me out. But I know when I was a kid, Twilight Zone was my favorite show. I wouldn't miss an episode of it for nothing. But my main question to you, what would be a good way for me to go about getting these out there?
Yeah.
Either I was thinking about maybe combining a bunch of these short stories into a book,
mm-hmm.
and I even have a title for it. I was thinking about calling it The Dimension Beyond.
Sure. Mm-hmm. There's a number of different ways to get them out into the world, and I think it's a great question. Among the ways you could do things, science fiction publishing is one of the more accessible genres. So there's the World Science Fiction Convention. It's held every year. There's also something called the World Fantasy Convention. The book editors, the book agents, and many of the most famous authors go to these conventions. You can meet them very readily. And when you meet an editor in person, it really kind of helps make it much easier to publish. There's also science fiction magazines. There's a magazine of fantasy and science fiction. There's a number of these magazines that publish short fiction, short stories. And so one can actually submit to these. The editors of those magazines also go to the World Science Fiction Convention and the World Fantasy Convention. So if you Google those, you can find out where they're being held this year, and you can go to them and you can meet these people. Another thing that actually is works for people nowadays is you can actually publish books on demand, and they can be listed with Amazon. It doesn't quite have the stigma it used to have. Years ago, it used to be more like vanity publishing, and people would look down their nose. That's not the case anymore. And a number of very successful authors have gotten their start by publishing, you know, themselves, and then just kind of promoting and banging the drum and getting the word out. So, you know, so that's one way to do it. Another way to do it is to contact your local film school or little cinema groups in your area and see if they might want to shoot one or two of your stories. And do them as like a web series, and that can also get a lot of notice and a lot of attention. So, I mean, Trey Stokes is this young director that I've been working with on Magic Time. He did a web series called Arc that's just about to come out, and it's phenomenal. It's a science fiction story, and you can get millions of viewers that way. So all of those things are possibilities. I mean, the main thing is just to get the word out any way you can.
Yeah, is what you're saying to me about the Google thing or whatever?
Yes.
Is that the same thing as self-publishing?
Well, it's similar, but if you go to the World Science Fiction Convention or the World Fantasy Convention, because all the major editors are there, you might meet an editor from Random House or an editor from one of the major publishers, and if they like you, if they meet you and they like you, and you say, "Well, could I send this to you?" They might very well say yes, and then they could buy it and it could be published by a major publisher. So I personally strongly believe in meeting people face to face. Even here in Hollywood, I'll often go to events where I'm meeting producers, I'm meeting directors, because it changes. It's like
the perception changes, Mark.
Yes, it does, because when you meet people, they're just people. They're most people can, you know, dress themselves and converse reasonably well. And so once you meet someone, it's not like something over the transom where there's just this, you know, person you don't know. It personalizes it, and that makes it a lot easier for things to happen.
Absolutely. Okay, let's go back to some final calls here as the clock ticks. We will go to Wapakoneta, Ohio, east of the Rockies. Go ahead, Matt. You're up with us.
Thank you very much.
Sure thing.
As a Star Trek and a Twilight Zone fan from way back. I heard you say something. I heard your guest, Mr. Zickery, say something about mentoring writers.
Yes.
I didn't tune in early enough to hear everything about that.
Yeah.
I have a full-length sci-fi religious fantasy novel that I've finished, but everybody who's read it tells me it reads like a screenplay and not a novel.
Mm-hmm.
I put too much detail into it.
Uh-huh. Well,
and
now you're wondering what to do with it, right, Matt?
Yes. I'll be happy to answer that. First of all, just to let you know, in terms of mentoring, my wife Elaine and I, we teach classes and mentor people both here in L.A. and long distance via the telephone and internet and so forth. But more specifically, in terms of your novel and the idea of converting it to a screenplay, I've written novels that I've turned into screenplays and also screenplays that I've turned into novels, so I've gone both ways. And it's basically the thing to do in order to learn how to do that is you can go online, you can find screenplays online. There's various websites like Script City and so forth. And the first thing is to read screenplays. You might even want to retype like 10 pages out of a screenplay. There's a program called Final Draft. It's a screenwriting program. There's another one, I think, called Movie Magic that just kind of show you the format. And then what you do is you read through your novel with a highlighter. And you read it two or three times, and you highlight in different colors what stands out each time, what things strike you. And then if you see what you've highlighted in all three colors, the things that really stand out, those are things to kind of preserve in a screenplay. Because the main thing with a screenplay is you boil it down. A screenplay should be between 100 and 120 pages. And you look for what's most visual. A script is basically what you can see and what you can hear. It's not about the internal monologue. And so then you say, okay, it has a beginning, middle, and end. You kind of, in your mind's eye, envision if you went to the movie theater and you're sitting watching a movie, how would it play out? What would entertain you? And then there are screenwriting classes. UCLA Extension has some very good screenwriting classes. You can do that online, and those are taught by professional writers. I strongly believe that if you're going to be undertaking writing a screenplay, it's really good to be taught by people who've done it for a living. A lot of these screenwriting gurus are people who tried to write scripts and failed and then became experts at it. So you don't want to be taught by those guys. You want to be taught by guys who've written scripts and sold them. And so then you... But so you boil it down to basically the basics, the basic nuts and bolts of the story, and then but you just jump in. I think boldness is very important, and there are many stories that can work as films and as books. My friend Ray Bradbury certainly has worked in both of those media extensively, as have I.
Does the writer who's writing a screenplay, a film, does he have to visualize the scenes? I always thought the director would do that.
Well,
I guess not.
Well, you visualize them to the degree that a big mistake a lot of beginning screenwriters make are two things. One is they'll have sort of long, long talky scenes that aren't visual. They'll have like people on telephones talking for page after page. These are things that would be very visually boring. And they over-describe. They'll have a character walk into a living room and they'll describe all the furniture in the living room. No. There's a screenplay I wrote called My Death Girl, a romantic comedy, and I simply described a living room as poverty inventive. That's it. And that sets the scene. So you just describe what's really vital.
If people want you to mentor them, can they go to their website, website, and email you?
If you go on to Zikri.com, it has information about our classes. You can email me, absolutely.
Do you think it's important to find a literary agent?
It's important, but not vital. For instance, if you're going to be a TV writer, it's a good idea to move to L.A. because this is where television
this is where it's
made.
Done.
But in terms of being a film writer or a novelist, you can live anywhere. But again, if you can fly to different industry conferences, if you can meet people face to face, even with Hollywood, there's for instance, on the Twilight Zone Blu-ray commentaries, I reached out to Matt Weiner, who created and runs Mad Men. And we did a couple of commentaries, and now he's reading some of my work and considering me as a writer for Mad Men. And that came from, again, meeting him personally. And I know many people who have no credits at all, where they'll meet someone. For instance, there's a TV show called Warehouse 13, and my friend David Simpkins is an executive producer on that show. He went to something called the San Diego Comic-Con, and he met a writer in the hallway who had written comic books, and the guy was very personable, and he met with him when they were hiring writers for Warehouse 13, and he ultimately hired him. But this was someone who'd never written television, but he just showed up and met my friend, and he got hired.
David's a good guy.
He is, very good.
San Jose, California, we go west of the Rockies. Hello, Rachel. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm so excited to be talking to both of you. I'm a huge fan.
Great.
Thank you.
Well, thanks.
So I wrote a horror script for a film that I called The Pool, and we had a company that was going to finance it, and they went under.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just had a bad run of luck, and it actually did go. It was well received by Todd Farmer, if you know who he is. He did the most recent My Bloody Valentine in 3D.
Sure. Yeah, you bet.
And his feedback was that what I lacked in experience, I did not lack in skill.
Good.
Which was good because it was my first one.
That's a good thing for him to have said. Here's several things that might be of use to you. Amongst the things, there's something called the Hollywood Creative Directory, and there's a volume called the Producers Volume. It comes out four times a year, and it lists all the production companies in L.A. and New York. And if you just read through that entire thing with a highlighter and you highlight the companies that you think would be good for your project, and particularly ones that have studio deals, because that means they have acquisition funds, that means they have money to buy your script. And then you can just start calling them, you can say what you just said to me, and if you call the VP of development or the executive in charge of development, some of them will be very open to that, and sometimes they'll say, well, do you have representation? And if you don't have an agent or a manager, you can say, well, I have an attorney, and often they'll accept submissions from an attorney. Or you can have a buddy start a management company, and that'll work too. You'll have a manager. Just anyone who's taken out a business license can be a manager. And then the other thing is, there's another thing you can do is you can shoot a movie. I mean, basically, I have a friend who who wanted, he was an editor and he wanted to be a director. So he built a spaceship in his backyard and shot an entire movie in that spaceship. And he's got distribution now. Someone stepped up and wants to distribute it. But he did it for about $20,000, shot an entire movie just with a little, you know, high def camera he bought and edited it on his Mac, and he was good to go. So it's very doable now to make movies and shoot stuff or make webisodes. I strongly believe in making things. I don't wait to be picked. I really like to jump in with both feet.
Well, we do. I am working with a director, and he it really is invested in the project, and we have made like our creature, you know, little pictures to show what they look like, and we were thinking about shooting just the first scene.
Yeah, it's a good idea to do that. I think that you have to realize this, that they have the people that you're trying to sell your scripts to have almost no imagination to the degree that they can't really extrapolate. So the more you can make it concrete by shooting a trailer, which is what we just did with Magic Time. You know, in Magic Time, all the machines in the world stop running and magic comes back. And even though I've written three novels and they hit the bestseller list of Magic Time, we still are shooting something to show the dragon and show the world and show everything. And by putting my friend Armin Shimerman in it, who's a well-known actor, it makes it real. And so if you can do that with your project, even if it's just a great minute and a half or 5 minutes, that can really help you enormously.
Can I ask you two quick things? So what was the name of the Hollywood magazine again?
It's called the Hollywood Creative Directory, and it's the producer's volume. And you can get it at Barnes & Noble or Amazon.com.
Okay, and will you give Ray Bradbury a high five for me for inspiring me all my life?
Yes, I will. I definitely will.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Science fiction writer Jerry Purnell just says hello to the world, too, by the way, in an email.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Super is. By the way, scientists today claim that matter and antimatter particles destroy each other on contact, but that they have now found that matter wins out by at least 1%. And
wow.
That might explain why we are still dominant.
Well, let's hear it for matter.
Yeah, you got that. It does matter, doesn't it?
Yes.
Honolulu we go. First time caller, Solomon. We only have about a minute or so. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to ask you just two real quick questions.
We'll get just one in real fast. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. What is the process, you know, what is the process of a successful film, or how do you know that kind of going in the right direction?
All right. How do you know that, Mark Zachary?
You know, you go by your gut. You always write. You don't try to imitate what other people are doing. You look at what thrills you, what entertains you. Just really write what you want to see. I think that's the most important thing beyond anything else, to just not write what you think is going to be popular, but write what you really love.
All right, Mark, my friend, you keep in touch. Good luck. I'll see you not this weekend, but next weekend in Pasadena.
That'll be great, George. It's always fun to talk with you.
All right, you take care of yourself. Mark Zachary. If you want information on my speaking event, just go to our calendar section at coasttocoastam.com, and it's all there for you. He's one heck of a guy, and I wish you well on all your television projects. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.